She wakes at dawn to impenetrable green. Light filters through layers of vine-encased rot, like a picture on the bulletin of a church reverting to paganism. Dennis's unasked question plays in her head. The glut of life outside her tent makes her wonder what good it does to save a species without all the epiphytes, fungi, pollinators, and other symbionts that, in the trenches of the day, give a species its real home. But what's the alternative? She lies in her bag a moment, picturing the campsite as pasture, 120 new square miles of cropland a day. And the shrinking forest only speeds the warming world, making it harder to feed. Back on the trail after breakfast, they come upon a stack of fresh-cut logs. The scouts fan out. In minutes, rifles pop, followed by a motorcycle grunting through the undergrowth. Elvis Antonio returns through the bush, waving his arms in an all-clear. Patricia follows him onto a rough approximation of a road running up into a pistolero shanty camp, evacuated in haste. There's little left but a stack of oily clothes, a bag of moldy manioc flour, soap flakes, and one Portuguese girly magazine that has made the rounds too many times. They set the camp on fire. The blaze feels good, a tiny orange reversal of progress. They hike along a stream bed to a plain that the guides swear will satisfy all Patricia's desire for rare seeds. She stops along the trail to inspect strange fruit. Anonas, soursop, bullock's heart, custard apple and wild varieties and hybrids, each one up to something. An incredible lecithis overwhelms her with crazy stink. There are silk floss trunks, armed all over with spikes. The collection vials come out. They find a dramatic bombax in flower, one unlike anything documented. Elvis Antonio appears at her side, laughing and tugging on her sleeve. Come see.
Sure, in a minute, yes?
Now is better. She sighs and follows into a bower of branches and mad lianas. Four of the men stand marveling at a big tree with buttresses like falling folds of cloth. She can't even guess the family, let alone the genus and species. But the species isn't what interests them. She comes behind the excited men and gasps. No one tells her what to see. A child could make it out, a one-eyed myopic. In knots and whorls, muscles arise from the smooth bowl. It's a person, a woman, her torso twisted, her arms lifting from her sides in finger branches. The face, round with alarm, stares so wildly that Patricia looks away. She steps closer to see the carving marks. What kind of sculptor would pour such skill and effort into a thing so remote it might never be discovered? But it's not a carving. No sign of sanding or woodworking of any kind. Just the contours of the tree. The men shout hot, fast words in three languages. One of the dendrologists claims, with too many hand gestures, that the wood has been somehow pollarded to look like a woman. The rubber tappers jeer. It's the Virgin looking on the dying world in horror.
Pareidolia, Patricia says.
The translator doesn't know the word. Patricia explains. The adaptation that makes people see people in all things. The tendency to turn two knotholes and a gash into a face. The translator says that's not a thing in Portuguese. Patricia looks harder. The figure is there. A woman in the coda of life, raising her eyes and lifting her hands in that moment just before fear turns into knowledge. The face may have been formed by the chance efflorescence of a canker, with beetles as cosmetic surgeons,
but the arms, the hands, the fingers, family resemblance. The impression grows stronger as Patricia walks around it. A dog would bark at the twisting body. A baby would cry. The myths come back to her in this tropical upland, stories from her own childhood and the world's. The young person's Ovid her father gave her. Let me sing to you now about how people turn into other things. She has come across the same stories everywhere she collects seeds. In the Philippines, Xinjiang, New Zealand, East Africa, Sri Lanka. People who, in an instant, sink sudden roots and grow bark. Trees that, for a little while, can still speak, lift up their roots, and move. The word turns odd, foreign in her head. Myth. Myth. A mispronunciation. A malaprop. Memories posted forward from people standing on the shores of the great human departure from everything else that lives. Send off telegrams composed by skeptics of the planned escape, saying, remember this, thousands of years from now, when you can see nothing but yourself everywhere you look. Just upriver, the Achuar, people of the palm tree, sing to their gardens and forests, but secretly, in their heads, so only the souls of the plants can hear. Trees are their kin, with hopes, fears, and social codes, and their goal as people has always been to charm and inveigle green things, to win them in symbolic marriage. These are the wedding songs Patricia's seed bank needs. Such a culture might save the earth. She can think of little else that can. Cameras come out of packs. Botanists and guides alike snap away. They argue over what the face means. They laugh at the stupefying odds against anything accidental growing exactly like this, like us, out of mindless wood. Patricia does the estimate in her head. The odds are nothing compared to the first two great rolls of the cosmic dice. The one that took inert matter over the crest of life, and the one that led from simple bacteria to compound cells 100 times larger and more complex. Compared to those first two chasms, the gap between trees and people is nothing at all. And given the outlandish lottery capable of producing any tree, where's the miracle in a tree shaped like the Virgin? Patricia, too, snaps away, capturing the figure imprinted on the bowl. She and the collectors bag some samples for ID. There are no seeds. They press on to more collecting, but every trunk now appears like an infinitely lifelike sculpture too complex for any sculptor but life to have made. She shows her photos to no one at Seedbed when she returns from her wanderings to the gleaming facility outside Boulder. Her staff, her scientists, her board of directors, no one has any use for myth. Myths are old miscalculations, the guesses of children long ago put to bed. Myths aren't part of the Foundation's charter. But she does show Dennis. She shows Dennis everything. He grins and cocks his head. Dependable Dennis. 72, and as capable of amazement as a little kid.
Would you look at that? Oh, man!
It was even eerier in person.
In person? I bet.
He can't stop looking, laughing.
You know, babe, you could use this.
What do you mean?
Make a poster out of this photo. Put a big caption underneath it. They're trying to get our attention.
She wakes up that night in darkness, with his big, gentle hands slack around her waist.
Dennis?
She tugs at his wrist. Then? In a flash, she twists out from under the limp arm and is on her feet. The room floods with light. Arms outward,
fingers spread, her face so frozen in horror that even the corpse has to look away. The violin maker with wood dust in his hair, the man who calms Dorothy and makes her laugh whenever she wants to buy an assault rifle, the man who wrote her a poem telling her where to look if she ever loses him, is begging her to marry. But the law has this thing about one husband at a time. Dory, I can't do this anymore. My halo's falling off. Sainthood's overrated. Yes, so is sinnerhood. You can't go on vacations with me. You can't even spend the night. It's the best 45 minutes of my day whenever you show up. But I'm sorry, I can't be number two anymore. You aren't number two, Alan. It's just a double stops passage, remember? No more double stops. I need a nice long solo melody before the piece is over. Okay. Okay, what? Okay. Eventually. Dory, Christ, why are you martyring yourself? Nobody expects you to, even he doesn't. No one can speak for what he expects. I signed the papers. I made a promise. What promise? You were on the verge of a divorce 2 years ago. You two had practically divvied up the estate already. Yeah. That was back when he could walk and talk and sign agreements. He has insurance, disability, two caregivers. He can afford someone full time. You can even keep helping. I just want you to live here, to come home to me every night. My wife. Love, as all the good novels know, is a question of title, deed, and possession. She and her lover have hit this wall many times before. Now, in the new millennium, the man who has kept her sane, the man who might even have been her soulmate if only her soul were a slightly different shape, hits the wall one last time and collapses at its base. Dory, it's time. I'm tired of sharing. Alan, it's share or nothing. He chooses nothing. And for a long time, she dreams of choosing the same. One crystal blue fall morning, a bellow comes from the other room. Her nickname, stretched out to the length of stillness without the final consonant. Da! Her skin creeps. It's worse than the bellow he makes when he fouls the bed and needs her to come clean him. Once more she runs, as if there never has been a false alarm. In the room, someone is talking to her husband, and he's groaning. She flings the door open. I'm here, Ray! At first glance, there's only the man in the frozen terror mask, the one she has gotten used to at last. Then she turns and sees. She lowers herself to the bed next to him. The television is saying, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, saying, that is the second tower. That just happened, live, on our screen. Some hard, skittering animal in the bed grazes at her wrist. She startles and shouts, her husband's movable hand knocking against hers. It's deliberate, the screen says. This must be deliberate. She takes his stiff, curled fingers and grips them. They stare together, understanding nothing. Orange, white, gray, and black billow against a cloudless blue. The towers vent like cracks in the crust of the earth. They waver, then drop. The screen staggers. People in the streets scatter and scream. One of the towers folds up flat like collapsible hanging shelves. The animal shrieking will not stop. Refusal trickles from Ray's mouth. She has seen this before. Monstrous columns, too big to be felled, falling. She thinks, finally, the whole strange dream of safety, of separation, will die. But when it comes to prediction, She has always been worse than wrong.
Hyde Street, in Nob Hill, on a block lined with camouflaged California sycamores and one crooked Asian plum that bursts out in cream craziness for 3 weeks each spring. Mimi Ma sits in her shade-drawn first-floor office, preparing for her second and final client of the day. The first lasted 3 hours. It was his contractual right to stay however long he needed, but the session polished her down to a blunted nib. The second one will suck the day's remaining life from her. She'll retreat to her apartment in the Castro tonight to watch nature documentaries and listen to trance music, then sleep and rise to face 2 more clients tomorrow. Unconventional therapists flood this city. Counselors, analysts, spirit guides, self-actualizing assistants, personal consultants, and borderline charlatans, many as surprised as Mimi to find themselves in the trade. But her reputation has spread so well by word of mouth that she can afford the office's absurd rent while seeing only 2 clients a day. The real question, session by session, is whether she can stay sane herself as her clients eat her soul. Many of her prospective patrons suffer from nothing worse than too much money. She tells them so at the screening interviews every other Friday. She won't see anyone who isn't in pain, and she can tell how much pain a person is in within 20 seconds of their sitting in the wing chair that faces hers in her bare session room. She talks to each applicant for a few minutes, not about their psyches, but about the weather, sports, or childhood pets. Then she'll either schedule a session or send the seeker home, saying, "You don't need me. You just need to see that you're already happy." For that advice, she charges nothing. But for a real session, there must be some sacrifice. 2 such sacrifices a day suffice to keep her afloat. She sits to the right of the bricked-up fireplace, recovering. In the anteroom of 50, she's still slim, from the distance running she has taken up, although the cowl of black hair has chestnut highlights now, still marked by the scar across one cheek that has never vanished. Her hand strokes her steel-gray jeans and travels the pleats of her cyan blouse, the one that makes her feel a little like a troubadour. Her office manager has called the next client to say that the therapist is free. There's just enough time to climb up out of the morning's 4-hour cauldron of fear, grief, hope, and transfiguration shared with a total stranger before plunging back into it with another. She bathes her mind in Zen aimlessness. She picks up one of the framed photos from the mantelpiece, the one of an elderly Chinese couple holding up a photo of 3 little girls. It's a studio shot in front of a backdrop. The man wears an expensive linen suit, and the woman a silk dress tailored in Shanghai before the war. The couple gaze sadly at the photo of their American granddaughters with the inscrutable names. They'll never meet these foreign girls, or their mother, that fallen Virginia scion, who will die in a facility after forgetting what species she is. And their wandering son. It's like the couple already knows, as the lens opens, at this precise moment, years before the violent crime. How does a man rise or fall in this life? The fisherman's song flows deep under the river. Once there was a little girl, bristly, a bully even, trying to preserve herself across a great divide. Not yellow, not white, not anything Wheaton had ever seen. Only that fisherman ever knew her, motionless by her side on long, slow days in untamed places, when they both stared and cast into the same running stream. She feels it again, worse for the unthinkable time and distance. Rage at his leaving. then rage at the world for cutting down the harmless grove where his ghost liked to walk, where she liked to sit and ask him why, where she once almost even got an answer. A chime shatters Mimi's reverie. Stephanie N., her afternoon guest, arrives in the front office. Mimi returns the photo and presses a button on the underside of the mantel, telling Catherine that she's ready. A soft knock on the door, and Mimi rises to greet an ample, wiry-haired redhead with tortoiseshell glasses. The hunter green tunic and its half cape fail to hide her paunch. It doesn't take a rabid empath to feel the visitor's broken mainspring. Mimi smiles and touches Stephanie's shoulder.
Relax. There's nothing to worry about.
Stephanie's eyes widen. There isn't?
Hold still. Let me have a look while you're standing. You've gone to the bathroom? You've eaten? You left your cell phone, watch, and all other devices with Catherine? Not carrying anything? No makeup or jewelry?
Stephanie is clean on all counts.
Good. Please sit.
The visitor takes the proffered chair, unsure how this can lead to the magic that her brother-in-law called the most bruising, profound experience of his adult life.
Wouldn't it help to know a little about me?
Mimi cocks her head and smiles. There are so many names for the thing that everyone is scared to death of, and everyone wants to tell you theirs.
Stephanie? By the time we're done, we're going to know more about each other than there are words for.
Stephanie daubs at her eyes, nods, laughs two syllables, then flicks her fingers. Ready. 4 minutes in, Mimi stops the session. She leans in and touches Stephanie's knee.
Listen, just look at me. That's all you need to do.
Stephanie palms an apology and reels her hand back into her lips.
I know. I'm sorry.
If you're self-conscious, if you're afraid, don't worry. It doesn't matter. Just keep your eyes on mine. Stephanie bows her head. She sits up and they try again. It happens often, this false start. No one suspects how hard it is to hold another's gaze for more than 3 seconds. A quarter minute, and they're in agony. Introverts and extroverts, dominants and submissives alike. Scopophobia hits them all. Fear of seeing and being seen. A dog will bite if you stare at it too hard. People will shoot you. And though she has looked for hours into the eyes of hundreds of people, though she has perfected the art of endurance staring, Mimi feels a tinge of fear herself, even now, gazing into the skittering eyes of Stephanie, who, blushing a little, powers through the shame and settles down. The women lock in, awkward and naked. A tick at the corner of Stephanie's lips makes Mimi smile back.
Sheesh, the client's eyes say.
Yes, the therapist agrees. Humiliating. The awkwardness turns pleasant enough. Stephanie, the likable, Stephanie, the good-natured, the mostly self-assured.
I'm a decent person, see? It doesn't matter.
Stephanie's lower lid tightens, and her orbicularis oculi twitches.
Do I make sense to you? Am I much like everyone else? Why do I feel like I'm falling through the cracks of social goodwill?
Mimi squints less than the width of 2 lashes. Microscopic reprimand.
Just look. Just look.
5 minutes in, Stephanie's breathing shifts and narrows.
Okay, I see. I'm getting this.
You haven't even started. Mimi watches the woman come into focus. A mother, and of more than one. Cannot stop taking care of the therapist. wife of a man who, after a dozen years, has become civil and distant, a bear in his lair. Sex is perfunctory maintenance at best.
But you're mistaken, the speculating therapist tells herself. You know nothing.
And the thought registers across the minute muscles of her face.
Just look.
Looking must correct and heal all thoughts. At 10 minutes, Stephanie fidgets.
When does the magic start to happen?
Mimi's eyes bear down. Even in this tedium, Stephanie's pulse rises. She sits forward. Her nostrils flare. Then everything relaxes from scalp to ankles.
Well, here goes. What you see is what you get.
What I get is beyond your control.
The weird shit in this room had better not leave it.
Safer than Vegas.
I'm not sure what I'm doing here.
Me neither.
I'm not sure I'd like you if I met you at a party.
I don't always like myself. At parties, almost never.
This can't possibly be worth what I'm paying, even if I stay all afternoon.
What is it worth to be looked at without judgment for as long as you need?
Who am I kidding? It's my husband's money.
I'm living off my father's inheritance, which might have been stolen.
I've let men define me.
I'm really an engineer. I'm only pretending to be a therapist.
Help me. I wake up at 3 a.m. with a black thing clawing my chest.
My name isn't really Judith Hansen. I changed it from Mimi Ma.
On Sundays when the sun goes down, I don't want to live.
Sunday evenings save me. Just knowing that in a few hours, I'll be working again.
Is it the towers? I think it might be the towers. I've been so brittle, like frozen glass.
Towers are always falling.
A quarter hour passes. Unrelenting human scrutiny. The weirdest trip Stephanie has ever been on. 15 endless minutes of staring at a woman she doesn't know from Eve triggers things. Things she hasn't thought about in decades. She looks at Mimi and sees a crow's-footed, scar-faced Asian version of her high school girlfriend, a girl she broke with at 19 over some imagined slight. There's no one to apologize to now, except this stranger who won't stop staring at her. Time passes. A lifetime. A few more seconds. In a room with nothing to look at but a stranger's damaged face. The trap closes around Stephanie, her eyes cloud with resentment bordering on hate. A tremor of Mimi's lips sends Stephanie back to that day 3 years ago when she at last faced down her mother and called her a bitch. And her mother's mouth, in that instant, Stephanie squeezes her eyes shut, rules of this game be damned, and when she opens again, she sees her mother, 8 more months down the line of panic, on a respirator in the hospital, dying of COPD. Fighting to keep all thought of that day's accusation out of her face as her daughter leans in to kiss her stony forehead. The watch that Stephanie left in the reception room ticks on, out of sight and hearing. Away from it, far from all claims on her, the visitor remembers herself, soft, sad, out of nowhere, at the age of 6, wanting to be a nurse. Toy props, syringe, blood pressure cuff, white hat, picture books and dolls. 3 years of obsession, followed by 35 of amnesia, retrieved only by going down the rabbit hole of another woman's eyes. Nothing else exists outside this pact. Pupils lock and can't look away. The years parade through Stephanie's mind. Childhood, youth, adolescence, the immunity of young adulthood, followed by endless scared maturity. She's naked now, in front of someone she has agreed never to try to see again after today. Through the two-way mirror, Mimi sees. Such pain you're in. Here, too. How can it be? In a patch of sun that falls between them, a green feeling opens to the light. Mimi lets it play across her face, there for the seeing. Therapy. You remind me of my sisters. She lets this woman in, up into the breakfast tree, backyard, Wheaton, Illinois, where she, Carmen, and Amelia have already taken their cereal bowls up onto the summer limbs and are busy reading each other's futures in the floating oat rings. That Virginia missionary's daughter stands at the kitchen window, the one who'll die of dementia in a nursing home without ever having looked her daughters in the eye for more than half a second. That Hue man coming from the house to call to his daughters, "My silk farm, what you do?" The mulberry, sweet, crooked, and open, rounded with shade, dripping peace, lying about everything the future would hold. A great sororal surge comes over Stephanie. She reaches her hand to this slight half-Asian shaman 4 feet from her. One quick tightening of Mimi's corrugator muscles warns her off. There's more. So much more. At half an hour, Stephanie melts down. She's hungry, stiff, itchy, and so sick of herself she wants to sleep forever. The truth seeps out of her, a bodily discharge. You shouldn't trust me. I don't deserve this. You see, I'm fucked up in ways even my children don't suspect. I stole from my brother. I left the scene of an accident. I've had sex with men whose names I don't even know. Several times. Recently. Yes. Hush. I'm wanted in 3 states. Their faces feed pitiless into one another. Muscles move, the world's slowest flipbook. Terror, shame, desperation, hope. Each lasts its own 3-second lifetime. After an hour, the islands of emotion wash into an open sea. The two faces swell. Their mouths and noses and brows expand to fill a Rushmore. Truth hovers between them, great and nebulous, a thing their bodies keep them from reaching. Another hour. Deserts of infinite boredom, punctuated by peaks of freakish intensity. More annihilated memories percolate up from below, so many moments recovered and lost again in this loop of looking. Hydra-like multiplying memories longer than the lives that made them. Stephanie sees. So clear now. She's an animal, a mere avatar. The other woman, too. Stuff-imprisoned spirit, deluded into thinking it's autonomous. And yet, conjoined, linked to each other, a pair of local gods who have lived and felt all things. One of them has a thought, which at once becomes the other's. Enlightenment is a shared enterprise. It needs some other voice saying, "You are not wrong." If only I could remember this in real time, under fire, I'd be cured. There are no cures. Is this it? Is there more? Maybe I should go. No. In hour 3, truths flow loose and terrible. Things come out of hiding that would lose them membership in any club but this one that they can't quit. I've lied to my closest friends. Yes, I let my mother die unattended. I spied on my husband and read his private letters. Yes, I cleaned bits of my father's brain off the backyard flagstones. My son won't talk to me. He says I ruined his life. Yes, I helped kill my friend. How can you bear to look at me?
there are harder things to bear.
The sunlight changes. Slits of light crawl up the walls. It occurs to Stephanie to wonder if it's still today, or if that was some time ago. Her pupils have long since started to seesaw, closing and dilating by turns, dimming and glaring the room. She can't even summon up the will to stand and leave. When it can't go on, that's when this will end. Then they'll never see each other again, except for always. Her eyes burn. She blinks, numb, dumb, ravenous, wrecked, and badly in need of emptying her bladder. Something keeps her from breathing. This frail, scarred woman who won't look away. Pinned in that look, she becomes something else, huge and fixed, swaying in the wind and pelted by rain. The whole urgent calculus of need, what she called her life, shrinks down to a pore on the underside of a leaf, way out on the tip of a wind-dipped branch, high up in the crown of a community too big for any glance to take in. And way down below, subterranean, in the humus, through the roots of humility, gifts flow. Her cheeks tense up. She wants to shout, "Who are you? Why won't you stop? No one has ever looked at me like this except to judge, rob, or rape me. In my whole life, never." Her face reddens. With slow, heavy, disbelieving swings of her head, she starts to cry. The tears do whatever they want. Call it sobbing. The therapist is crying, too. "Why? Why am I sick? What's wrong with me?" "Loneliness. But not for people. You're mourning a thing you never even knew."
"What thing?"
"A great, spoked, wild, woven-together place beyond replacing. One you didn't even know was yours to lose."
"Where did it go?"
"Into making us. But it still wants something."
Stephanie is up and out of the chair, clinging to the stranger, taking her by the shoulders, nodding, crying, nodding. And the stranger lets her.
Of course. Grief. Grief for a thing too big to see.
Mimi pulls back to ask if Stephanie is all right. All right to leave. All right to drive. But Stephanie puts fingers on her mouth and hushes the therapist forever. The changed woman makes it out onto Hyde Street. Two facade painters up on a scaffold yell at each other over a blaring radio. Men with dollies unload stacks of boxes from a delivery truck 6 doors up the street. A guy in a dirty suit jacket and shorts, his hair bound up in a bungee cord, cuts behind her on the sidewalk, talking out loud. Voices or cell phone? Choose your schizophrenia. Stephanie steps into the street, and a car screams past, the rage of its horn dopplers downward for another block. She fights to hold on to the thing she has just glimpsed. But traffic, bickering, business, the street's brutality begins to close in. She walks faster, on the brink of the old panic. Everything she has just won begins to fade again into the irresistible force of other people. Something sharp grazes her face. She stops and touches her scraped cheek. The culprit floats in front of her, purple-pink, the colors of a 5-year-old's crazed sketch. Escaping from a metal cage in the sidewalk near her feet is a thing twice her height and half again as wide as her extended arms. A single, stout, upward path splits into a few thinner ones, and those divide into thousands more, thinner still, each one tentative, forked, full of scars, bent by history, and tipped out in insane flowers. The sight takes root in her, ramifying, and for a moment longer she remembers. Her life has been as wild as a plum in spring.
Just down the road, 2,000 miles east, Nicholas Hole drives into an Iowa June. Every dimple in the land, every remembered silo just off the interstate, twists his gut, like the last thing he sees before dying, like coming home. The math stuns him. How few years he has been away. So much has gone untouched. The farms, the roadside warehouses, the desperate public service billboards. For God so loved the world. So many imprints from deepest childhood, permanent scars in the prairie and in him. Yet every landmark seems warped and remote, seen through dime store binoculars. Nothing here should have survived where he's been. Over the last rise to the west, before the exit, his pulse shoots up. He looks for the horizon's lone mast. But where the column of the whole chestnut should be, there's only June's annihilating blue. He heads the car up the exit ramp and drives the long square back around to the farm. Only it's not a farm anymore. It's a manufactory. The owners have removed the tree. He parks the car halfway up the gravel drive and walks out across the field toward the stump, forgetting that the field is no longer his to walk across. 150 steps in, he sees the green. Dozens of fresh chestnut shoots spring up from the dead stump. He sees the leaves, the straight-veined, toothed lances of his childhood that always meant leaf to him. For a few heartbeats, resurrection. Then he remembers. These fresh starts, too, will soon be blighted. They'll die and rise again, over and over, just often enough to keep the deadly blight alive and vigorous. He turns toward the ancestral house. His hands lift to reassure anyone in the parlor who might be watching. But it's the house, in fact, and not the tree that has stopped living. Siding pulls away from the walls. On the north side, half a length of gutter hangs down. He checks his watch. 6:05, obligatory dinner hour throughout the Midwest. He crosses the weedy lawn and walks up to the east windows. They're matte, dusty, lusterless, dimmed with only dark behind them. The stiles, rails, head jam, and all the wood around the double-hung panes soften into paint-peeled rot. Cupping one hand around his eyes, Nicholas peeks in. His grandparents' living room is filled with metal basins and canisters. The oak trim that covered every doorway in the house has been stripped away. He walks around to the front porch. Its planks wobble beneath him. 5 raps of the brass knocker yield nothing. He climbs the rise behind the house to the old outbuildings. 1 has been torn down. 1 is gutted. 3 is locked. His old trompe-l'œil mural, that crack in the wall of the cornfield revealing a hidden broadleaf forest, is gunmetal gray. On the front porch again, he sits where the rocker used to be, his back to the front window. It's not clear how he should proceed. It crosses his mind to break in. He has spent the last 3 nights sleeping rough, scared shitless by a cow near the Bighorns in Wyoming, who nuzzled him in his bag before dawn, kept awake in a national forest in Nebraska by 2 campers setting endurance records in a nearby tent. A bed would be nice, a shower. But the house, it seems, has neither anymore. He waits for the softening smudge of Midwestern dusk, though there's no real need for cover. Far away, a satellite-guided agribiz monster, practically robotic, combs through the rolling fields. No one will pass here or see him at his task. He can do what he needs to, and go. But he waits. Waiting has become his religion. There's corn to listen to, miles of it. beans to watch grow, sheds and silos on the horizon, an interstate, and a huge tree cut out of the sky in negative space, like a Magritte. He sits with his back against the house, feeling the farm emerge again, like wild animals from the edges of a trail when the hiker holds still long enough. As the clouds crimson out, he heads to the car and retrieves his folding campfire shovel. Wrong tool for the wrong job, but the best he has. In a minute, he's on the rise behind the machine shed, looking for loose gravel. The ground feels different. The distances are wrong. Even the machine shed has been moved. The scree turns up, hiding under a lush green shag. He snicks the campfire shovel into the weeds and digs until he hits the past. Return of the repressed. He hauls up the carton and opens it. Panels and some works on paper. He holds the top painting to the day's last light. A man lies in bed, staring down the tip of a large branch that comes growing in through his window. That's how it happened. He was sleeping, and she burst in. Each of them had half a prophecy. They put them together and read the message. They found their joint calling, their shared vocation. The spirits guaranteed that all would be well. Now, she's dead. He's sleepwalking again, and the things they were to save are all going down. He sets the carton down beside the hole and digs again. The second box surfaces, filled with paintings he forgot he made. Family tree, shoe tree, money tree, barking up the wrong tree. All painted in the years before she came up the driveway, with stories of resurrection and voices of light. The paintings proved that they were meant to head off together. The paintings were wrong. He stacks the second box on top of the first and keeps digging. The shovel tip hits something jagged, and he finds the sculpture load. He and Olivia buried four of them loose to see what the living soil might do to the ceramic skins. Dirt. Another thing she taught him to see, a new inch or two every few centuries, a microscopic forest, 100,000 species in a few Iowa grams. He drops to his knees, pries out the pieces with his fingers, and wipes them with a spit-dampened handkerchief. Their monochrome surfaces now shine as rich-hued as Bruegel's. Bacteria, fungi, invertebrates. Living workshops down in the underground horizons have spattered patinas across the sculptures in a masterpiece of blooms. He sets the transmuted statues on top of the rescued boxes and returns for the real prize. He wonders again what he could have been thinking, leaving it here. Travel light, they thought. Bury the art. Digging it up later would be its own performance piece. But the thing still in the ground is worth more than his own life, and he should never have let it out of his sight. Six more shovelfuls, and it's his again. He opens the box, unzips the bag, and holds the 100-year stack of photos in his hands. Too dark to see now, to flip through them. He doesn't need to. Holding the stack, he feels the tree spiraling up into the air like a corkscrew fountain, watched over by generations of holes. He carries half of the trove down the rise, back to his car. He gets the loot into the trunk and turns back for the rest. Halfway to the burial site, two white lights pierce the gravel driveway from the dark road. Police. The thing to do is walk toward the squad car with open palms. Every explanation can be documented. The evidence will support his story. Trespassing, yes, but only to retrieve what's his. He comes out from behind the house, and the headlights veer toward him. It occurs to him that the buried treasure in question might not, in fact, be his any longer. He sold the land and everything rooted in it. buying and selling land, as absurd as getting arrested for recovering your own art. The squad car jerks up the drive, its wheels spewing gravel. A blast of spinning red stops Nicholas in place. The car swings to a stop, flaring into a barricade. Siren whoop gives way to an amplified voice.
Freeze! Down on the ground!
He can't do both. He raises his hands and drops to his knees. Travels back 40 years to a grade school skit. The rain came down and washed the spider out. Two officers are on him in a heartbeat. Only then does it strike Nicholas that he's in real trouble. If they fingerprint him, if they run his record...
Hands out!
One of the officers presses into Nick's back and draws his wrists together. Once he's cuffed, they sit him up on the ground, shine a flashlight in his face, and take his data.
It's trinkets, he tells them. Worthless.
Their faces curl when he shows them his art. Why would someone want to make such things, let alone steal them back? The only part of the story that makes sense to them is the burying. But the older cop recognizes the name on Nick's driver's license. Part of local history. Landmark for the whole area.
Keep going, a mile, mile and a half, past the whole tree.
They call the business manager in charge of the property. The man has zero interest in bits of dug-up rubbish. Rural Iowa, the police don't look up his arrests in the national database. He's just another semi-delusional, semi-vagrant from a ruined farm family, driving a dinged-up car and trying to hold on to a vanished past.
You can go now, the police tell him. No more digging on private property.
Can I just... Nick waves his hand toward the unburied treasure. The officers shrug.
Knock yourself out.
They watch as Nick puts the last cartons in his car. He turns to them. Have you ever seen a tree grow 80 years in 10 seconds?
You take care now, says the cop who pinned him to the ground.
Then they send the 3-time arsonist on his way.